Another day ashore, and while I write this, I have fearsome worry and fearsome joy. My worry is that I have no more shop to sleep in, for it was taken ashore to be rebuilt, and the carpenter says that might take weeks. I found an old piece of canvas and fashioned it into a hammock, such as a sailor sleep in. It hangs in a quiet corner of the tween deck. Here I write. I miss the shallop, but my joy is that I wear clean clothing for the first time in weeks. My underclothes, shirt, and hosiery smell of which is sharp and free of the foul smells of London. All the women went ashore this day to wash the clothing. How they scrubbed, as if to wash the very stench of the old world from our things. It was a day of sun and bright sky. The children went ashore. They dug clams and mussels, and with the dogs chased flocks of gulls. I explored with the expedition. The first thing we saw was a school of whales. They played hard near us. Right off the shore, very near the Mayflower. One of the men, seamen fired his musket, but the gun only blew up in his face. I am glad, for the whales seemed so peaceful. The elders on the expedition decried the fact that they had not brought tools to harvest the oil from the whales. If they had, they could have paid our debt. Paid back our debt to our London backers in 2 weeks instead of the months that farming and fishing will take. A league or so down the beach, we spied some men with a dog. Miles Standish, who led us, urged caution, for surely they were savages. Savages with a dog? Where did they get a dog? He played about on the beach just like our dogs. We were prepared to meet the savages, our first in the New World, but as soon as they spied us, they disappeared into the woods. The dog did not. He kept running towards us. Captain Sanders said, whatsoever we did, we must not shoot the dog, or we would have war before we officially claimed this place. He ordered us to double time and give chase to the man in the woods. As we did so, a sharp whistle came from the forest, and the dog, too, disappeared. But we followed, seeking their footings. One man said we were being foolish. The Indians might be planning to ambush and kill us all. I must confess, Tom, I was fearful. But I would not let anyone know of it. At any rate, soon we were in such darkness as we could scarce see. Our clothing was torn by brambles and thorns. We followed Captain Standish for what seemed like an hour before we came out of the woods onto the bay at shore. There were some large clearings, and we could see they had once been cornfields. Here we made a fire and camped for the night. Our hands and faces were cut by the undergrowth and the thickets. We had some biscuits and cheese. Then they passed around a flask of brandy. Elder Bradford said I might have a sip, as there was no water. I got out my book, quill and pen, and ink, and commenced to write, close enough to the fire that I could see. The men watched me. Then Mr. Hopkins asked what I was writing. I told them that it was an account of my adventures for you. They then inquired how I had come to write. An indentured boy, as I was so told, was. So I told them about our father and how we were not always poor. Elder Bradford nodded and said, give a good account of us, boy. Do not reveal the truth. I said I would. This day we breakfast. This day we breakfasted on our poor victuals, prayed, and moved on. Soon we came upon a valley full of bayberry, long grasses, and brush. A number of little paths ran through it, and we discovered why. Water. The first fresh water we had found since we dropped anchor. It was a small pond, and Elder Bradford bade us all stand in a circle. We graciously believe the Lord is with us, he said. As we drink this first water in the new land, let us be nourished by it and prosper in our endeavors. And so we sat down and drank. Elder Bradford then said he had never tasted of the wine at the court of King James's, but he supposed this to be heatier brew. After that, we came upon some large clearings which must have been used by the Indians as cornfields. Here we found many carefully built mounds of sand. One was covered with grass mats and had a piece of anchored wood over it. Soon we were on our hands and knees digging it out with shells. I found some arrows. I had never touched an Indian arrow, and I ran my hands over it. What fine work, Tom. I wanted to have it, to keep it, to bring it back to the ship and show everyone. Someday I would show it to you. I asked Captain Standish if I could keep it. No, he said, for this is likely a grave. See the bow they have put with the arrows? When Indians bury a warrior, they send him on his way with all he needs. He then said we must respect their graves, so I put the arrow back. We restored the grave and proceeded on. We came to a small river, which Captain Standish said could one day be used as a harbor. After that, we climbed a sandy hill and found a large meadow on the other side. More heaps of sand freshly made. Surely they could not be that many graves, so we decided to investigate. In the first one, we found a large basket that Captain Standish pronounced very handsomely and cunningly made. In it were four bushels of corn, some still in the ears. There was some discussion as to whether we should take it or not. Certainly God has led us to it, Elder Bradford said. It is a gift for us from the very ground here, from the new land, from this. It is a gift to us from the very ground here, from this new land. What think you, Captain Standish? Captain Standish said he didn't have frequent discourse with God, but that we certainly needed the corn, and that we should post a guard at the very moment if we meant to take it. So we did. When we are established as a plantation, we will grow our own and return it in kind, said Elder Bradford. So we took it along. Some men stuffed ears of it in their pockets. It was yellow, red, and blue. Indeed, there was too much to carry, so we left some. Before we left, we looked around at the fine country and espied a small river to the south. We commenced marching, stayed one behind the other. Soon we found two canoes, one on either side of the river, as people would do who would ferry back and forth. We stood and looked at each other. The country was occupied, this we knew well. For all we knew, the occupants could be watching us at the very moment, ready to let fly an abundance of arrows. We must be careful. We wanted to investigate the river to find fresh water, but that would mean going miles inland. Governor Carver had said to remain out no more than 2 days. So we made our way back to the freshwater pond, set good watch, and camped the night, making sure to burn a goodly fire so those aboard the ship could see we were still alive. Last night I heard beasts in the forest, cries that bore no likeness to those of any man. Twice I woke at the sound. Were the beasts angry that we were here? I shivered. It was so cold. All around me we heard huddled forms. The fire burned brightly, and our guards were alert. At the second waking, we climbed out from under my blanket and made my way to one of them. It was Mr. Tilly. What is that sound? I asked. We know not, lad, he asked. Answered, it could be the evil one for all we know, but we are at the ready. Have no fear. Whatever it is, still, whatever it is, will not venture from the forest. I went back to my blanket and lay awake, gazing at the stars, and thought that we would perish in this wilderness. Then I thought of Elder Bradford, a scholar, a man of goodly inheritance. He'd sold his house in Holland and given all he had to come here. I thought of my master, always so severe, yet he is made of both iron and velvet. His anger comes slowly, but his will is strong. He drinks only water when others drink beer. He too is from the upper classes, but threw his fortunes in with these people. His fortunes in life. The printing shop where he had worked in Holland was ransacked, which is why he woke me that night to flee with him to England. Since our time there, he has shown me many small kindnesses and that others' masters do not show their bound servants. I thought of all the other good people I had come to know on the ship. Edward Winslow, a man of property and education. Isaac Ellerton, a tailor. Will Mullins, who had made shoes. John Alden, a copper. The men who had rocked and soothed the children, prayed through the storms at sea, and never complained. What gave us the right to think we could cross the ocean and start a new world? But I knew, my master had told me, Queen Elizabeth, who came before King James, had cut off the head of Mary Stuart, her cousin, who was Queen of Scotland. She thought Mary was sending servants to poison her. Then Queen Elizabeth said to her people, it was wrong to cut off this woman's head. I had no part in it. It is the fault of my Secretary of State, Mr. Davison. She sent Davison to the Tower of London. She sent Davison to the Tower of London. Davison's clerk was my master, Elder Brewster, who knew the only thing he could do was leave the court. After all, the queen might ha take his head too. You can never tell with queens. So Elder Brewster went back to Scrooby Manor with his home. So Elder Brewster went back to Scrooby Manor, his home, and prayed and plotted and waited and held secret Sabbath meetings. And he and his friends became a congregation. In 1603, King James came to throne. Elder Brewster and his congregation in Scrooby went to Holland. They spent over 10 years there. Their children began to take on the ways of Holland, ways too free for their parents' liking. They were afraid their children would forget they were English, so they looked for someplace else to live. But where? Guiana? Sir Walter Raleigh had gone there, and where was he now? In the Tower? The coast of South America? Too hot. America, some said. They had heard about this place far across the ocean. True expeditions there had failed. People in Maine and Roanoke were never heard from again. Jamestown was a financial failure. What about the area around the Hudson River? The Dutch were doing well there. Cold, someone else said. Ice and snow, savages and beasts. Never mind, Elder Brewster and his congregation decided to take their chances with the savages and beasts. They know why they are here, and so do I. In the morning, we made our way through the forest and back to the Mayflower in the freezing rain and wind. We were tramping through the woods when we espied a sapling bent low and forming an arch over our path. Stephen Hopkins warned us that he had seen such traps in Virginia. Indians trap deer in them, he said, be careful. But Elder Bradford, last in our single line of march, did not hear us. He stepped right into the trap and was soon dangling upside down by one leg. When we had loosened him finally, he said the trap was a very pretty device, made with a rope of their own making and having a noose as cunningly designed as any roper in England can make. We tried hunting, Tom. There were deer in abundance, also partridges, great scores of geese and ducks. But our matchlocks were too clumsy, the men too noisy, and we knew we would have to learn more about this place before we brought home such bounty. So we waded some tidal creeks and lugged our corn over sandbars until we finally found the beach again. One man fired his musket, and a party came to welcome us from the Mayflower. They called our expedition Second Discovery. All were thankful for the corn. Elder Bradford told us that when Israelites entered the Promised Land, they too had gone with 16 men and brought back the fruit of their land for their brethren. Everyone was marvelously glad, and afterward, when they went our separate ways, Mistress Bradford came upon me. They were not 16, she said. They were 12. You made them 12. I nodded. Why did you not say, she asked. Because, I answered, I would not disabuse them of their feeling that this is their promised land. It is no promised land, she told me. It is a wild and desperate place. Then she disappeared into the bowels of the ship. I saw a light in her eyes, Tom, that came from no warmth inside. It was most strange, and it frightened me. For a moment, I pondered going to her husband and asking him to comfort her. But then, what right had I do this? A mere boy? I did not go. I spent hours afterward thinking, should I have? All of a sudden, things have come to a halt. We wait for the shallop to be repaired so we can explore further and find a place to settle. The weather has turned even colder, and we have no shelter on land. Everyone argues the matter. Some went to settle here and start building now. Others say no, we must find a better harbor that can welcome ships for trade. That this place has only small freshwater ponds that may dry up in the summer. No matter where I go on this ship, there are people huddled in heated discourse. Some will not talk to others. How can people stand up to a king and be so brave on the one hand and so mean to one another? Elder Bradford said that someday generations to come will honor us for what we do here. How we are dirty and hungry. We smell, we fight with each other. We grumble and are so sore afraid. How? I tried to get ashore each day to get away from the ship, if only to bring back wood. The food aboard is dwindling and of poor quality. The crew grumbles that the victuals will not last the winter. They say we should settle somewhere, or surely they will put us off the boat. Today I minded Damaris. I read to her from a book my master gave me. Also, I was given some of the corn to shell for the seed for spring. It was put in the common store. This day I did not go ashore, though I had planned to. I came upon Mrs. Bradford crying. Can I do anything for you, mistress? I asked. Shall I fetch your husband? She said her husband was too busy being an important elder to care about her tears. Today he may walk the waves. I cannot disturb him, she said. Tom, I think there is a hint of madness in this woman. But I told her only to hush, that I would read to her if she wished. She bade me sit at the foot of her bunk and do so. While I was so engaged, Edward and Dottie and Edward Leister came by, grunted, kicked my leg, and sneered. Then turned and gave me a look such as would wither the cockles of anyone's heart. I shall suffer a bit for my kindness to Mrs. Bradford, but I care not. I almost had a fight today. I was getting ready to leave the ship to go ashore when Edward Doughty and Edward Leister came upon me. Where are you off to, little wharf rat? Doughty asked. I told him I was going to find wood. He laughed and asked, wouldn't you rather sit on the bunk of Mistress Bradford? I told him not to reveal the name of such a good woman. You rotten little maggot, he said, always looking for favor, No wonder you get to go on expeditions while we fester on this old tub. I told him kindness was not a for look. I told him kindness was not looking for favor. Then why didn't you stand firm with us when we argued about our liberty before going ashore? Lester asked. I told him I was too young to have a voice in such matters. They began pushing me in about while accusing me of other things. They said I was becoming a puke stocking and gave me a hard push. I fell and my book tumbled out of my pocket. They grabbed it and began to ruffle through it. I demanded it back. One word led to another. There was no telling what would have happened had not Mr. Hopkins come along. Are you coming ashore, lad? He asked me. I said yes, as soon as I reclaimed my property. He only had to look at Dottie for him to give my book back to me. As I climbed down the rope ladder to the long boat, Dottie peered over at me. You're still a puke stocking, he said. It's only because you write drivel that they let you go along. Not because you're of value as a man. Why don't you stay aboard and hold the hands of women? Dottie and Lester were big and strong. Why won't Mr. Hopkins take them? True, they are feisty and bold, but so is he. Should I ask Mr. Hopkins to take them next time? Why should I? I am not a puke stocking, or any of the other things they call me. The shelf is finally pronounced ready to sail. Another expedition is planned. Talk and speculation run wild. Who will go? Where will they go? How soon? Today I approached my master and told him Dottie and Lester wished to be included. He nodded, but said only that he would bring the matter up for discussion. Edward Thompson, a young servant of Will White, died yesterday, coughing and worn thin. It bodes no good. Many others are coughing and taken ill too. The elders say we can delay no longer. If there is to be an expedition, let us proceed, but where to? They have consulted Second Mate Robert Chopin. He has been to these shores before. He pointed across the bay, saying there lies a good harbor less than 24 leagues away. I am selected to go with many others. We go on the morrow. Dottie is to go, but not Lester. After Lester was told, I saw him huddled with Francis Billington, who is my age and a troublemaker. The whole family bodes trouble, always arguing, raising doubts, causing rifts among the passengers. I think no good will come of those putting their heads together. I was right, and sorry I did not bring the matter of Leicester and Billington to someone's attention. I could prove no wrong intent, yet this day, as we ready to leave on the expedition, we are halted by a great explosion and came from the tween.